proceeding with our scheduled business, we have one of the family occasions that we enjoy, which is the addition of one of our law clerks to the bar of the court. I suspect Judge Prost may have a motion to make.
Thank you. I move the admission of Matthew Allen Pengay, who is a member of the bar in good standing of the highest court of Texas. I have knowledge of his credentials and am satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications. Matt's been a clerk in my chambers for a year. He carries on an important tradition that we have, which is almost always to have one of our clerks be from Texas. And Matt is from Texas. Anything about him is from Texas. It's been a pleasure to have him. He's got, he's a talented young man who brings a lot to the job, including a sense of honesty and decency, which I think we all appreciate.
Well, we have the motion, and I will waive the need for a second. I'll consult with another panel member.
We have another Texan in the bar. We haven't had an alliance between Texas and Massachusetts since 1964, but I will second that motion and welcome you to the bar.
The motion is granted. Mr. Henday, would you step forward and take the oath from the court?
Please raise your right hand. You swear or affirm that you will comport yourself as an attorney and counsel of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
I do.
Congratulations and welcome to the bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
Welcome to the bar, Mr. Henday. May you practice well and successfully. We have four cases on the calendar today. Two cases involving claims against the government on the Court of Federal Claims, application from the District Court, government employee case that is being submitted on the briefs and therefore not be argued. First case is St. Christopher Associates versus the United States, 2007-5069. Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Harry Kelly. I'm counsel for the plaintiff in this case, St. Christopher Associates Limited Partnership. Your Honors, there are many, many fascinating facts that pervade this case, but fortunately, for purposes of the present discussion this afternoon, it's a rather narrow issue, and that is simply whether HUD has the contractual obligation to approve, which has the contractual obligation to approve rent increase requests for Section 8, Section 236 property. Can refuse or fail to consider such a request when submitted by an owner such as ours.
So let me see if I understand. You're not contesting the judge's conclusion that the statute and the regulations in the handbook by themselves are not one mandate.
That's correct.
You're just saying that they, and in order to reach the conclusion you wish us to reach, which is there's some obligation to have given oral hearing or consideration, is in the, not in the contract, but it's in the contract insofar as the contract incorporates the statute and regulation.
The way I would phrase it, Your Honor, is that I think that the statute
is... Excuse me, may I interrupt? Is our counter...
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, a little bogus.
I'm sorry.
Your Honor, the way I phrase it is this. I think if you look at the express language of the regulatory agreement between the parties, look at Section 4A, and look at Section 4L specifically. There are a few other provisions that are relevant, so those are the chief ones to consider today. They impose an express obligation upon HUD to approve rent increase requests or to approve rents for the property. It seems to me, both as a matter of language, of logic, and of legal necessity, that if an agency of the federal government, such as HUD, has that express contractual obligation, then as a prerequisite to that, it must consider the rent increase.
They don't have an obligation to approve, right?
Well, they have, I should say that the only rents that can be charged are those which HUD approves.
Right.
And this is not a case, as some others have been in other jurisdictions, where we're contesting a factual determination at the end as to whether or not HUD did the right thing. We're simply asking whether here, if HUD is going to exercise its duty of approving the rents when an owner files a request, HUD must, in the first instance, it seems to me necessarily, at least consider that request. I don't understand how the agency can exercise the other portions of its express contractual obligations here without, in the first instance, considering the request. It's a necessary prerequisite. And I do think that that is an express duty that the agency has in the contract, insofar as it has a duty to approve rents, to, in the first instance, consider it.
But where does that take you, though, in terms of damages relief? You're not suggesting, are you suggesting that they had an obligation to approve that request?
I would not say that they, obviously, from my client's point of view, as a factual matter, we would believe it. Had the agency looked at the application that was submitted, it would conclude that it indeed should have.
But that's not my question. Right. My question is whether or not you can enforce some requirement that they were to approve, that they would approve a request that you make. There's some enforceable obligation.
If I believe that what we can enforce is the obligation, at least in the first instance, to consider that. And since that's a first step, nothing else that the agency doesn't, in the first instance, is consider that request. None of the other relief or the obligations that we in the agency has can.
In other words, you want us to find a breach of contract?
Yes, ma'am.
And you hand in a question of damages?
I think that there may be some additional intervening matters that the government may have with respect to the parties' respective obligations. But ultimately, that is the question that we would be seeking, Your Honor. We are seeking those damages, which we believe flow as a proximate result of this government's.
The damages being all the rents that you requested in the increase you didn't get.
That's correct.
Mr. Kelly, you're not asking for a taking type of damage. You're saying it's a contractual obligation which was breached by HUD by not considering the rent increase?
That's in the first instance our argument, Your Honor, and that is the primary argument which I think the plaintiff advances today. We have indeed also advanced an alternative argument, the taking space one, where we believe that because if there is a situation such as this where the government is operating in a sovereign capacity, and I do think this is, after all, the document we're talking about is called a regulatory agreement, and it is a contract not to purchase pens or papers, but to carry out a sovereign interest of the government, which is to provide affordable housing to lower income families in the nation. When the government is operating in that position, if it fails to take the action as a result of the failure of the action that it took here, my client was put in the position of providing housing for lower income families on a basis that was not fair, not the appropriate level. But I think that there was a taking, there was an invasion, if you will, of my client's property.
But you voluntarily entered a program in 236 program. And under that program, you had rent control.
Well, we have
under that specific aspect of it, did you give up that right to increase your rents?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that we agreed to abide by the terms of the of the contract. Allow the HUD to, in the final instance, approve the rent increase request that we wanted. But I don't believe that we abandoned the right to be able to say that the agency did not do what it should have done.
But the government didn't take any action.
Took no action, that was the problem, Your Honor.
But how can that be taken?
The failure to, the issue was whether as a result of the, or as a consequence of, in this instance, the government's inaction, its refusal to do what it should have done. We were in a situation where the government was essentially expressing a dominion and control over our property in a manner that was without contractual basis.
But it wasn't a fiscal taking.
Well, not all takings are fiscal, Your Honor. Some takings.
It's not a categorical taking. Even if they took something by inaction, they didn't take all value.
They did not take all of the value, Your Honor, but this is a situation where for a period of 40 years we had to do a regulatory agreement with the government and subjected ourselves to a large battery of obligations. The taking in this instance, and I think that there are a number of decisions from this court, would take the position that where there is a diminution in the value and the financial interest, it doesn't have to be able to.
But that's all
regulatory taking, isn't it? You're still arguing on a regulatory taking that that's contractual obligation was imposed upon the agency.
It would be a regulatory taking in that instance.
So what are the aspects of the regulatory taking that would be established as a partial taking?
Well, I think that the case that we brought to mind would often would be, for example, the city of Byron's decision. Parties in this instance, in this case, were subject to a regulatory agreement, and the parties to the city of Byron's decision were also subject to a regulatory agreement.
Which are the scene of a series of cases?
To my knowledge, are all of the plaintiffs in the city cases were subject to similar, not necessarily exactly the same regulatory agreements, because they changed from year to year at different points. And depending on which...
they were talking about the repossession of real property. I don't understand your takings claim, because I guess I understand your damages claim, but you would suggest that because you don't know whether they were approved yet. But there's nothing that obligates the government to grant the increase. Nothing whatsoever. And so you're saying that by not considering, I'm just not understanding what was taken.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that I think the taking arises where the government, I think that if you recall the Pennsylvania Coal Company case, they were talking about regulatory action, which goes too far and may constitute a form of taking as well. It seems to me that it is not a far stretch to say that when the government fails to do what it should have done, a taking may arise. If at the end of the day, what the government gets is access to our property that is not properly compensated for, then I would submit that constitutes a taking that should.
That's predicated on the fact that there was some obligation for them to grant the increase.
True, Your Honor.
Going back to the contract, so you've got kind of two theories going. One is that we ought to incorporate the regulations in the handbook into the contract, but your view is even if we don't buy that, the contract in itself, the language of approval, inherently includes the obligation to consider. Is that not correctly saying the theory?
I'd say we would not say that the contract necessarily incorporates all the statutes and all the regulations in the handbook. But we would say that those should be examined. The cases that we cited talked about the fact that when you are dealing with a document such as this, as a regulatory agreement, which carries out a sovereign purpose of the government, it's appropriate to look back at the statutes and the regulations to see what they envisioned, how they understood, what they intended the obligations of the parties to be here. And that's why we invited the court to go back and take
But assuming we don't buy that, or at least we don't construe the court, the contract is necessarily incorporating the obligations of the statute and the regulations. Then even if you're right that approval inherently requires the government to consider it a request, there's no time frame in the contract. I mean, it seems to me you're asking us to renegotiate a contract for you because there's no time frame. Even if you're right, the government has to respond at some time. Is that 4 years, 5 years, 10 years? Is there anything that necessitates them responding within a certain period of time?
It would seem to me, Your Honor, that again, the contract should be construed so as to be reasonable. And if an owner submits a rent increase request, come back to us a year later seems to me pretty unreasonable. To come back 2 years later, even more unreasonable. But to never come back, to never respond at all, seems to me to be beyond the scope of what it would be deemed to be reasonable. Did
you inquire as to why it was taking so long?
We had been in contact with the agency for many years prior to this time, Your Honor. As of the time this rent increase request was filed, we had gone 13 years, it was 13 years, yes, without receiving any rent increase request that we had denied prior requests. So subsequent to this, there was a follow-up letter that was sent. And then a few months after that, we received not a response to this request for rent increase, but a notice of foreclosure. And I guess the owner considered that to be the government's response, such as it was. But there was never any response made at all to this.
I don't want to trivialize this, but let's assume, as it happens, that I have kids who want to use the car, and they know the rule is they're not going to get to use the car unless I approve their use of the car. Does that mean inherently that every time they ask me to use the car, I am obligated to give them any answer? Because can't the answer be, don't ask me anymore, I'm not going to answer you unless I'm ready to give it to you, and then I'll let you know? I mean, why does the fact that I have the authority to approve it necessarily obligate me to respond to every time, to tell them yes or no every time they ask?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that cases such as Beck Park Apartments. We know the owner has a right to ask, and it isn't the situation that the owner asks for rent increase requests every day. but most would do it perhaps on an annual basis, or in many instances over several years. The fact of the matter is that on the one hand, the owner cannot ask for more, for a rent increase. He can always ask, but he knows that unless he can demonstrate in good faith that there is a reason to grant the rent increase, HUD is likely to turn it down. So as a result, they will ask when they believe that they have a necessity. In this instance, it had been 13 years, and we feel that under the circumstances that our client acted in a commercially reasonable manner, it's the burden should be on HUD, having received it, to explain why it didn't do anything.
Why isn't the burden on the contracting party to put all that language in the agreement?
This is a contract of adhesion, Your Honor. You're forced to abide by the language which the agency
provides. The agreement itself would have been put in that the rent increases will be complied to in 3 months. It's fairly easy to put in an agreement.
And there are regulations which HUD published in the context of our earlier discussion, which I think if you look at the Part 245 regulations, which set out time periods and so forth. And I think the owner had a reasonable expectation that where a regulatory agreement on the one hand says that the owners would be subject to the HUD regulations, that the agency itself would abide by its own terms as part of the contractual provisions.
Well, to your final time, you want to say that?
I would. Thank you very much, Thomas. Thank you.
Ms. Floyd.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. The plain language of the regulatory.
Let me, before you get into that, I was a little confused by the record here. There was some suggestion that initially HUD said they never received the request, but then the government acknowledges in its brief, does it not, that they're not contesting the money.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
So we are to assume for our purposes
for these purposes, the government received the request. The plain language of the regulatory agreement specifically provides that their paragraph A provides that the HUD commissioner will approve the basic rental charge and also the fair market rental charge.
I think the agreement is clear as to the requirement that they file a request for a rent increase, but is it fair for a participant in the program to wait 5 years to have no answer from HUD? In the meantime, should they have brought an APA type of an action forcing HUD to act on its request?
Your Honor, that option was there. The agreement is, as I argued already, on its face, does not require HUD to entertain a rent increase request. Nevertheless, there are provisions, regulations that set out what a rent increase request should look like. And if the owner complies with those requirements and HUD fails to satisfy those requirements or act on the request, then they can take an APA action.
But HUD is one of the contracting parties.
That's correct.
Both parties to the contract subject to a fair dealing type of a situation, where if I request a rent increase, that I would be expecting an answer, not 5 years hence, but within a reasonable amount of time. Is that unreasonable for a party to anticipate?
Your Honor, it's not unreasonable for a party to anticipate that a response. Nevertheless, it's not an obligation that was imposed upon HUD as in the context of the contract itself. But so there was no obligation.
But HUD does have an obligation in fair dealings with the parties to the contract.
HUD has obligations.
I'm asking you, do you think it's fair to wait 5 or 6 years before an answer is given by one of the parties to the contract? I know they have no obligation to grant it, or at least reply to the request.
Your Honor, that is what one would expect in an ordinary course of business, yes. Nevertheless, there are certain requirements under the contract, and while this is an argument that the court below never reached, our position was that they never complied with the regulatory requirements to submit a rent increase request. So, independent of all of that, Your Honor, there are certain obligations under the regulations themselves that an owner must comply with, and they would not comply with in this instance.
So you think that even if we agreed with the other side, we have to send it back so that the court could consider that alternative argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the issue here, are they complaining that HUD didn't consider the request or that HUD didn't respond to the request? Because the two may not exactly be the same thing. How do you see the complaint here?
It does get conflated in my mind, and in briefing that I did not see that distinction. Certainly, they did make the argument at some point that HUD was required to grant it, and we argued below that is not a requirement. So,
if we were to agree that the regulatory and the regulations and the statute of incorporating our reference somehow in the contract, then we government loses, right? Because the regulatory, do you not consider the portions of the regulation as requiring a response within a particular period of time?
Your Honor, our position is that because they never complied with the regulatory...
Oh, that's the other issue.
Yes.
So the other issue governs that. But outside of that other issue, if you look at what the district court reached, without that, then the government agrees there's some obligation in the regulations or the statute to respond to those things.
In the regulations themselves, there's a discussion of a 30-day window. But in order to comply with that, there are certain prerequisites that the owner must satisfy. And these are not satisfied in this instance.
And there's no finding on the district, even though the court of claims didn't find that it had.
That's correct, Your Honor. It never addressed that issue. The parties fully briefed it, but it was never reached by the court.
Well, the agreement provides, as you quoted, that there should be a basic rental charge. And the statute defines basic rental charge as the amount needed to operate the project. That pretty much applies to the inflationary environment interests. Doesn't that also imply an obligation on the part of to respond to requests?
It doesn't follow, Your Honor, and although it's not a matter of the record here, this situation, this apartment was located in Hartford, Connecticut, and in fact, it was in a very declining market situation. So just because you and I are used to inflationary spirals doesn't mean that every market has inflationary spirals. And it doesn't also imply that simply because the owner submits a budget-based rent increase or a budget-based request for a fair rental value or basic rental value, that in fact that does not allow for that it doesn't allow sufficient cushion.
When we look at the regulations, when processing a request, that there can be requests and that they will be processed. And the next paragraph says, after HUD has considered the request for an increase, it will furnish the Board Joe a written statement of the reasons for approval, adjustment, upward or downward, disapproval. There's something missing here.
Well,
there's no obligation to respond.
In order to even fall within those regulations, you must submit a request within the meaning of the regulations. And a request includes the initial submission, which the September 1997 document was. It also requires a posting of the intent to increase the rent. And then the submissions that are provided by the tenants within 30 days must then be provided to HUD or some explanation as to why there were not.
But you're arguing an issue that is not before.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I'm trying to explain why in this instance there wasn't even a rent increase request submitted.
But if there was no rent increase submitted, which met all of the regulatory bases for the rent increase, all T's were crossed,
right,
and all the I's were dotted, why didn't the agency send a letter back to them saying, you have not properly submitted your request, go back and take a look at the regulation? But they just sat quietly by the sidelines and said absolutely nothing.
Your Honor, we were not able to determine why there was no action. We, for the purposes of the mailbox rule, we agreed that we received it. But there is no indication in the record below who received it, when it was received, and why no action was taken. So I can't really address why in this instance there was nothing done. There were foreclosure proceedings instituted in March of 1998, so fairly soon after this request was submitted. HUD initiated its foreclosure proceedings pursuant to its underlying note with this particular owner. The owner came into the property as a substitute owner because the previous owner had basically failed to pay its obligation. So St. Christopher came in and obligated itself to pay back the old mortgage payments that had not been paid before. And because these weren't paid, HUD had taken the position that it wasn't obligated to act on its rent increase. This was back in 1988.
So. With respect to the takings claim, do you think that they have any basis for a takings claim under these circumstances?
No, Your Honor, we do not. We made the arguments in our brief, and I stick with those arguments in terms of whether or not this was even a sovereign act by the agency in particular. They were operating in their commercial capacity, not in their sovereign capacity. But even if we got to the point of examining this as a taking, there was really no change in regulation that you could call a taking action here. It was really that the two parties were acting as a landlord and tenant, or a landlord and an owner, and it was in a commercial capacity, not in a taking.
What about, we've agreed that there's no dispute before us any longer about whether or not the statute of regulations are not in the end. So they're not, but there are obligations in the regulations. Is there some other way that the other side could enforce those?
The option for the owner is, had it complied with the regulations, and I've already argued that it hadn't, it could proceed before the district court and take an action to enforce its rights under the statute of regulation.
As Judge Kramer said,
yes,
suggested earlier.
That would be the option for St. Christopher. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Floyd.
Any questions?
Mr. Kelly has a couple of minutes left to rebut.
I said just have a thank you.
Can I just ask quickly about considering and answering? Is there a difference? Is there a bit of distinction? Are you objecting to their not having considered the request, not having answered it, or clearly both joined?
I believe that they are joined, Your Honor. I don't believe it makes a difference, but regrettably, we don't know what the agency did because we sent the materials to them and we never heard back. So we don't know whether they tossed it in the basket. We don't know whether it just sat on someone's desk and disappeared over the course of many subsequent years. That's why we phrased it. It could be either one. Either they refused to consider or they failed to consider or ignored it. But that is really the threat that we do face here today, because the judge's opinion is extraordinarily broadly written and could be implied to say that what happened to my client could happen to any party with which HUD is, any owner with which HUD is a party, and not just in connection with Section 236 programs. If HUD does not have an obligation in any program 221D3, which is also a budget-based rent increase program, but in many other instances, if the agency is simply allowed to ignore a legitimate
request. Well, they're not. There's a way to easily remedy that, which is to enter into a contract that obligates them to do it.
I think, on the one hand, Your Honor, I think every contract was required to envision every single situation which could possibly arise. The regulatory agreement here would be much, much longer. But I think that
raising the rents in a particular situation for real estate, I think that's a critical element. That's your cash flow. If you don't cover that particular aspect of it, you can't can't cover your mortgage, it can't cover your expenses or otherwise. I would presume that a lawyering aspect would be to require the government to answer within a specific amount of time. If you put it in a contract, there's no question that they have to do it.
All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that this is a pretty government contract. This is the form we're required to use. But if you look at the HUD guidance, HUD already had said in the handbook of guidance example, it is your obligation, field office, to make sure that these people have enough money to operate the property. Because if they don't, the property will go into default, and we, HUD, will end up having to pay off the mortgage. It seems to me that there was sufficient reason to believe, any owner would look at this guidance and believe that HUD is going to live by its own rules. And I would say, moreover, that even if you want to just look at the owner's obligations itself, HUD has an obligation as part of any contract to make sure it does not frustrate the other party's ability to perform its obligations. And here, the owner had an obligation to make sure to operate the property in good condition and to meet the other provisions.
But that suggests that there's some obligation for them to approve the registry. So we have no idea whether that's appropriate.
But it does have, but since an owner has a right to make an application, and there is case law to that authority, and since HUD, on the other hand, is the only party who can decide what those rents are, then it seems to me to be an absolutely necessary outcome that HUD must consider, and then either approve it or not. Thank you.
Kelly, I can tell you, I can't tell you how it will come out, but we will consider it and we will answer it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it very much.